Welcome, everyone. Today, we have a very special guest. We have Michael D. Brown, the U.S. Senator from Washington, D.C. How are you doing today, Mr. Brown?
I'm doing great. Thanks. It's nice to be here with you, Jamie.
Thank you so much, Mr. Brown. All right, we'll get right into it. And before we get into D.C. statehood, which is the crux of really what I want to talk about, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, how you got started in politics, and how you got involved in the push for Washington, D.C. statehood?
Well, you know, I came out of college and I started working for President Jimmy Carter on his reelection campaign. And that led me to a job at the DNC, Democratic National Committee, where I was for 3.5 years. I studied political science in college, got a master's degree in public policy. So that was my career path I wanted. I ended up at DNC for 3.5 years. Then I did a short stint running a big public interest group, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And I didn't like public interest as much as politics. I wanted to get back into politics. So I left and I started doing consulting work in politics. And I did that. I built a firm with $800 I borrowed. I built a company that a little consulting firm that built out over $1 million a year. And I did that for 25 years. My wife would tell you that I didn't have a job for 25 years. I was just looking for one, but it was a very successful company. And then I decided at one point, I said, you know, what am I doing? I'm making money and that's great. I grew up a pretty poor kid and that was good, but I had money and I wanted to do something. I said, you know, I want to do something. I don't want my kids someday when they say, maybe my grandkids say, you know, what did your dad do? Say, I don't know. He made money. But, you know, because that's what I was. I was a guy that did direct mail. So I hung around the house and I wrote letters on my computer and I sent out mailings and I arranged for 1 million-piece mailings. And I did printing and all sorts of I don't know what you'd call them, but I provided the services and products that politicians needed. And we were good at it, very, very good at it. So I looked around to see what I could do. And I saw that there was this job, senator, and didn't know much about it, did a little research. Knew the Paul Strauss, who's the other senator and was the senator at the time, but didn't know there were two of them. And there was. It was another lovely lady named Florence Henderson. What was her name? Florence Pendleton. And I ran against her and I won in the primary. And, you know, I just never thought I would beat her, the incumbent, and a very well-known activist from Ward 8. And I beat them both, won every precinct in Washington, wow, all 143 precincts. Then I ran for re-election. And in 2018, I won again. So now I'm on my third six-year term. I've done this for 15 years. And I think we're getting closer and closer and closer to our goal. It's been a very rewarding job. It really has.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you said you won your bid for senator and you've been described as a shadow senator. And since DC isn't a state, your role might be a little different, I'm assuming, from traditional senators. So right, what exactly is your role as a DC senator and what exactly do you do?
Well, that's the most amazing part of the job, is that it has a very limited job description. So I really do whatever I can do. Okay. So I have a radio show on the internet that's getting 1 million hits a year. A couple weeks ago, I put up a sign in my front yard that's the size of a billboard that basically says, well, I got a copy of it right here. Maybe I can hold it up and show it to you. It says, I'll read it to you. It says warning in big red letters. And it says, you're entering the District of Columbia, the nation's capital. Caution. Residency may result in the loss of your basic civil rights. Be advised that revocation of your rights does not relieve your responsibilities for obligation to the state for which you may be liable. And then under it says taxation without representation. Well, we got that on every TV station in Washington, D.C. NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox all covered it. And a couple of publications as well, like Washingtonian and some other people. And the reason I did it is because my house just happens to be the very first house you pass when you come into the District of Columbia on Massachusetts Avenue. And there used to be a welcome sign there, but for some reason, it's no longer there. And so I said, well, let's put up a real welcome sign. So one of the things that I do is whatever I can do. You have a podcast, so you understand that these things are not very expensive. I have a producer and everything, and still it's not a very expensive enterprise, right? So I could afford to do this. And in fact, the show's been on the air 8 years, and for the first 3 years, I paid all the expenses because I got no funding from the government. I live in the first house in D.C., so I got to do that. I was a PR guy, so when the Democratic Committee took statehood out of their platform, I went to the convention. I'm a superdelegate to the convention, and I arranged with a billboard company to put up two giant billboards outside the convention center with traditional kind of American artwork, Washington crossing the Delaware with a big sign that said, stand up for the rights of DC residents, support DC statehood, and another one of everybody signing the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution that said, form a more perfect union, DC. And the next convention, DC statehood was back in the platform. So I could do that because I knew billboard people. You know, I'd worked with them for years, and I found a couple, and they wanted $10,000 a billboard, and all I had was like $8,000. And I said to them, look, guys, I've done you a lot of favors. And they said, okay, we'll give you a billboard. And I said, no, I want two. And they're like, well, I said, look, man, you don't know what part of the convention center they're going to cut off for security. And I said, what if my billboard's across the street and nobody can see it because it's in a restricted area? I want one on either side of the building so people are sure. So we not only got one right outside the building, but we got one that's backlit. And it was amazing at night, right on the main drag. So, you know, I do whatever I can. And when you ask me my official duty, I lobby on Capitol Hill, obviously. Right. I've got people to sign on to our statehood bill. And I've been a superdelegate, for example. So I have a few roles to play. I've been a superdelegate. I don't know if your folks know what a superdelegate is, but it's an uncommitted delegate. And I get that by virtue of my elected office. So I've been an Obama delegate twice. I've been a Clinton delegate, and I do those sorts of things. I've also speak internationally. I've already talked to you about UNPO, but in 2019, Mother Teresa University awarded me their Man of the Year. And I went to India and gave speeches in India. So I get to do a lot of things, you know, cool things. I've been a college commencement speaker. I've been, you know, I spent a day with Dan Rather one day. I've gotten to do a lot of cool things too.
So is it more of like are you more of like a grassroots activist rather than like a federal government worker in a way?
Well, the Congress doesn't recognize me. So yes, I fall into that federal role that you're talking about occasionally, but I act more like an activist. So right now, let me give you the perfect example. They're going to have a hearing in the United States Senate on the bill that I've helped get co-sponsors on Tuesday. It's going to be before the Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. They won't let me speak at that hearing. It's really what my mandate says. The mandate that created my office says that I'm supposed to speak to Congress on the issue of DC statehood, but they won't let me speak. So we've organized a campaign for people to call in and say, you know, let this man speak. This is what he was elected to do. And we just found out 10 minutes ago that we've crashed their system where they get phone calls. It's full. You can't leave any more messages. So, you know, I get ignored a lot, and everything's a struggle. Everything's a fight. So I tend to be an activist. You know, I say 50-50, but it's really more like 70-30. I'm an activist. Yeah.
Right.
I've been arrested. I've gone to jail. I've gone to trial. I'll tell you a great story. I go to trial and I stand before the judge, and he looks down at me and he says, "You are my hero." He said, I admire so much people who stand up for what they believe. And then he pauses for a second. And he goes, "But even the heroes can't sit in the damn road." Boom. And he blends. He says, "You're guilty." You know, so I had to pay $100 fine. And, you know, I forget, and restitution of some sort. I can't remember what, but it came to like $125 or something. But it was funny that first he started out, "You're my hero." He goes, but even heroes can't block traffic. So, you know, what the hell do you think you're doing? And we did it because a handful of us did it because the federal government had taken funding, local funding, for abortions for poor women out of our budget. Now, they can't do that anywhere in America except D.C. They can do whatever they want with the laws. The Constitution says legislative authority in all cases whatsoever over the District of Columbia. So they can do whatever they want in the district. And the really, really horrible thing is that any congressman or any senator can do it. So the representative from Wisconsin, if they don't like something, can interfere in the middle of our business. You know, any member of Congress. So, so we sat in front of the Senate and we blocked it. And I got to tell you, I felt guilty because some poor SOB coming home from work made a right-hand turn just as we sat down. And, of course, the Capitol Police stopped them. And he was there for the next 2 hours sitting in his car. I'm sure he was like thinking, "I'm going to run this guy over. I'm going to," you know. So I'm an activist a lot of the time. Yeah.
Right. Right. So obviously you devoted much of your life to I guess, D.C. statehood. So I want to get into the push for D.C. statehood. So why is there a push and need for statehood? Why do residents want it? And I guess for how long has this been going on for? Is this more of a recent thing or since the inception of
our country? The push for statehood really has been going on for about 50 years. But the push to expand the rights of D.C. residents has been going on for 220 years. There's been different iterations. We've gone to court. We've gone legislatively. We had a constitutional amendment that passed both houses of Congress and went out to the states and couldn't get enough states to ratify it, which would have given us two senators and a voting representative. We had another bill to give us a vote in the House that had passed the House twice and passed the Senate, but it never became a law either. And this has led us to statehood, which is the best resolution for us. And also in a lot of ways, kind of a last resort. We've already tried everything else. We've gone to court. Every time we've gone to court, the court says the same thing. They say, "We feel your pain, but you don't have a legal problem. You have a political problem. You know, you cannot have something declared unconstitutional that's actually in the Constitution." And the Constitution is very specific about the District of Columbia. That's the only jurisdiction it's very specific about. So the courts are not a place where we can find any kind of relief. So why statehood for the district? Well, because all states come in on an equal footing. And in the District of Columbia, we cannot make a law without the tacit approval of Congress. We can't pass our own budget. The President of the United States signs two budgets, the federal budget and the budget for DC. Congress can interfere anywhere it wants to. For example, we had a needle exchange program to cut down on HIV/AIDS in the district. And Congress took it out of the budget every year for 10 years. And they only allowed us to have it. And this was locally funded when we became the number one city in America with new HIV cases. So, you know, people have died over this. And but statehood makes us equal. We're just like everybody else. If we become a state, we get control of our budget. We get control of our legal system, and we get two United States senators who vote and somebody in the House of Representatives that vote. So that's why we want statehood, because it makes us equal.
There's no representation for residents currently.
None. No voting representation. We have a delegate in the House of Representatives. Her name is Eleanor Holmes Norton. She's been our delegate for a while, but she has no vote on the floor. She has a voting committee, listen to this. I mean, this is so absurd. She has a vote in her committee unless there's a tie. If her vote breaks a tie, it doesn't count. So the vote is cosmetic. It's ceremonial. It doesn't mean anything really. And she has no vote on the floor.
Right. So where do things stand now? Are we any closer to statehood? Will it ever be achieved?
Well, I think it has, you know, it certainly will be achieved because we're the only democracy in the world that does this. We're the only democracy in the world that does it. One of the reasons that we travel internationally and we talk internationally is because we want to make it clearly understood to the American government that this is an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment if you go to a place like Iran or you know, Kazakhstan or someplace else and you talk about, you know, suppressing the vote or keeping the people down. Because they do that in the District of Columbia. So, you know, I think it's inevitable. But when it will happen, I don't know. We're going into this hearing Thursday, for example, and they're saying the same old things. The Republicans are saying it's unconstitutional. Democrats are saying, no, it's not. And we have experts on both sides. They're saying the 23rd Amendment's a problem. And we don't think the 23rd Amendment's a problem. But the real problem, the Republicans don't care about the constitutionality or the 23rd Amendment. They care about two more Democrats in the Senate. That's the whole issue at this point. And we're not discussing it. We're not talking about it. So we're closer in the sense that we passed a statehood bill twice in the House now, and it's now in the Senate. And we have a president who has told me personally that he would sign it if it ever came to his desk. He's actually put out a proclamation in support of DC statehood. But we've got to, as it stands now, we've got to have 10 Republicans get on the bill for it to pass. Now, in the whole history of the United States, there's only been one Republican, a man named Gilchrist, who was a congressman from Maryland, who's ever voted yes on DC statehood. So the likelihood of getting 10 Republicans is very, very slim. So this is our path to statehood. First, we have to get the couple of Democrats who are standing in our way. Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Sinema of Arizona. We have to get them on the bill. Then we have to suspend the rule. We have to suspend the filibuster. And our argument for suspending the filibuster is, number one, it's been suspended twice before. And if you can't suspend the rule for something as basic as the right to representation, which is the most basic right of citizenship, what good is the rule? And, you know, if there's no exception to the rule, it becomes a tool of tyranny instead of a rule that, you know, can be helpful. And then secondly, the Constitution is very, very clear that all it takes is a majority vote for a territory to become a state. So there are several states that barely made it. They made it by one or two votes. So the idea that you have to have 60 votes instead of, in this case, would be 51, just absurd. And I think we can argue, I don't know that we'll get over with it, but that the filibuster needs to be put aside for this one issue. Right. And then we'll have enough votes. We'll have 50 votes. And as we all know, Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, can break a tie. And she is a strong supporter of D.C. statehood. She was a co-sponsor of the Senate bill before she got into the before she became vice president. And her the senator that follows her is also a supporter of the bill. So we're sure that she would support the bill. We're sure the president would sign it. But this is a big mountain. We got to get over the we got to get rid of the filibuster or get 10 Republicans. We're not going to get 10 Republicans. So we're close, you know, but there are people out there doing the touchdown dance and at the very best we're at the 50-yard line.
Right. So it's just insane for me to think that there's people in the U.S. who don't really have a voice, so to speak.
Right.
So you kind of mentioned this a little bit, but in a 2020 interview, former President Trump was quoted as saying D.C. statehood would never happen. So I know obviously Joe Biden hasn't echoed the same sentiment, but what is his stance on it? I know you mentioned it a little briefly, but if you go a little more in depth into that.
Well, first of all, he's told me personally that he would sign. I talked to him in Iowa at the caucuses. And like I said, I was a consultant for 25 years, so I know a lot of these people.
Right.
And actually did work on his first presidential campaign. But he told me that he would sign it. And then I want to say 3 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, the White House actually put out a statement in support of DC statehood. So he's not only told me and other people he supported, he has come out publicly and said, I want to make this happen. So that's the strongest support I think we've had since Bill Clinton actually went up and testified on our behalf in front of Congress. President Obama, when he was asked the question, said that D.C. should be a state, but that was in a press conference. He also told me personally that he would sign the bill if it ever got to his desk. But, you know, Joe Biden, I think, President Biden has made the strongest statement for D.C. statehood.
Oh, wow. So just to play devil's advocate, I guess, wouldn't it make more sense to join Virginia or Maryland, like the neighboring states?
You under the Constitution, you can't do that unless you have the consent of both parties. Now, Maryland is not going to consent understand that all the land in the district came from Maryland. The part that came from Virginia has already been given back. But the remaining part, which is from Maryland doesn't want us. And I'll tell you why. Because the Republican Party in Maryland has no interest in getting 450,000 new Democrats. Washington, D.C. would also become the largest city in Maryland because we're bigger than Baltimore, and Baltimore is really the only urban center in Maryland, only large urban center, and D.C. is bigger. So the Baltimoreans don't like it, and people in the rural areas have no desire to double their urban population. So there's a lot of obstacles. Statehood is the easiest path in that sense, in that if the bill passes both houses of Congress and gets some signed by the president, it's a done deal. There's no negotiation. Now, other people have suggested that what would make sense to get Republican support is to take Northern Virginia and make a new state which incorporates Northern Virginia, because then we get all the Democrats and the rest of the state stays Republican. And as you probably know, Virginia, for example, right now has a Democratic governor, 2 Democratic senators, even though the state is solid, you know, more solidly Republican. If you look at it geographically, the northern part of the state, which has the most population, is solidly Democrat. So some people have suggested that, but you know how complicated that would be to reabsorb Alexandria and Fairfax and McLean and all that area. Yeah, and I'm not sure they would go for it. And then there's the people that live in the District of Columbia that don't feel like they need to go become Marylanders just because, you know, the Republican Party doesn't like the idea that we could be our own people.
Right.
You know, our own state.
Right. So obviously a lot of people, I guess, people might be against D.C. statehood. Are there any cons to DC statehood, or are there any cases that people might make that seem kind of reasonable to you, or is it all nonsense?
Well, you mean in terms of the people of the District of Columbia?
Yeah.
There's very little downside for the people of District of Columbia. There are a few things. First of all, the government runs our prison system, which is bad. We don't have a prison in District of Columbia. It's pretty bad that they do that for the prisoners, you know. So if you're convicted, let's say you're convicted of some kind of small time offense, okay, and they put you in jail and they want to rehabilitate you, the first thing they do is they ship you off to Texas or California or some other place. They separate you from your social network forever, for however long. You know, and this doesn't work very well for incarcerated people. So we have to take that back, and that costs about $1 billion. So some people complain that that's a real downside of this. And it is something that we have to consider. But we have a $17 billion budget in a city that's less than 10 miles square. So we have a lot of money. And also, we're the only jurisdiction not allowed to tax people that live outside our jurisdiction. So it was called taxing income at its source. So if you live in New Jersey and you work in New York, you pay a tax to New York, which you get to take off on your New Jersey taxes, you know, and that's how it works everywhere. If you live in Wisconsin, but you drive to Indiana or Michigan or someplace every day to work, you have to pay that state a partial tax, and that gets rebated to you. But of course, the state that you take it from, you know, loses income, but you don't lose income as a individual. And a public interest group called DC Appleseed says that we lose about $2 to $3 billion a year by not being able to tax income. You know, the population of the District of Columbia doubles in the daytime because so many people work.
Right, call it to work.
I think most people that are involved in this fight see that downside of reabsorbing the legal system, which will cost $1 billion, offset by the fact that we'll be able to tax revenue at its source, and we'll be able to make that money up anyway.
Right. So moving on. So DC has a historical African-American population, and many actually see DC statehood as a racial justice and civil rights issue, as opposed to just a political issue. So how would DC statehood ultimately help minorities, specifically African Americans?
Well, first of all, you get two African American senators, most likely. If you look at the makeup of the District of Columbia right now, you've got an African American mayor, and there's never been a mayor of the District of Columbia who wasn't Black. Now, we've only had a mayor for 45 years, but there's never been a mayor that wasn't African-American. So they would get more representation in the Senate, which is important. Not a whole lot of Black people, not enough Black people in the Senate, let me say that. We also have a large Hispanic population. They're very likely to get represented. And also, we're very progressive. We're a very, very progressive community. So the politics that come out of here will be progressive politics, and they'll help minorities. Those policies, you can bet that, you know, in Washington, D.C., we were one of the first jurisdictions to have same-sex marriage. We have legalized marijuana. There are proposals to let 16-year-olds vote, and, you know, to let incarcerated. I think we now let incarcerated people vote. We're very, very progressive. So a lot of those policies would also help minorities.
Right.
And, you know, the famous saying from our first delegate to Congress, there was a guy named Chipman back in the 1800s. But in modern times, the Reverend Walter Fauntleroy was our first delegate to Congress. And he used to say the problem with statehood for the District of Columbia are the twos. That we're too liberal, we're too Black, we're too Democratic, and we're too Democrat, and we're too urban. So You know, it's always been a race issue. And this is certainly a civil rights issue. This is, that's what this is. It's a civil rights issue. Just like the civil rights battle in the South, we have the same kind of opposition. I mean, think of what they're saying to us. They're saying to us, you can be, of course you can be equal. Nobody says the people of District Columbia can't be equal, but you need a constitutional amendment. You can be equal, but you need to go back to Maryland. You can be equal, but first you need to get rid of the 23rd Amendment. These are what we call red herrings, and they were used during the civil rights movement. Of course, Black people can vote, but they need to take a literacy test. Of course, Black people can vote, you know, cast their ballot, but they need to pay a poll tax. Of course, African Americans can still vote, but they need to show ID. You know, these are the obstacles that have always been put in front of people who are pursuing their civil rights. And that's exactly what's going on with us today.
Right. So last question for you. I know you have to jet somewhere at two, but when do you think DC will ultimately achieve statehood? And what do you think a future state of Washington, DC would look like?
Well, I don't think it's hard to predict when they would get statehood. You know, if they can get something, you know, if they can do the things that I outlined for you, which are not easy, get rid of, suspend the rule and get all the Democrats on board, they could have it shortly. They could have it in the next few years. If they don't do that, they may have to wait for the stars to align again. You know, let's say President Biden gets elected and we get more members in the Senate, and in 2028, we win both houses, but the Republicans win the White House. Then if you pass the bill, you got a Republican that won't sign it. You know, so it, you know, we could have it sometime soon, and it may take another 30 or 40 years, who knows? But it will happen ultimately, because we're the only democracy in the world that does this. And I often say, you know, in 1991, I had a job at the convention, letting people up on the podium, and I met Rosa Parks. And I said, I've often said, I'm sorry I didn't ask her, did you have any idea what was going to happen when you didn't give up your seat on the bus? You know, did you understand that you were going to create a firestorm? And I think that's what's going to happen with DC statehood. There'll be a seminal moment when people come together around the idea, and that'll make it happen. But that hasn't happened yet. You know, it's hard when you had the civil rights movement going on and Black people were being shot with fire hoses, young people, and all the stuff that went on in the South that was broadcast all across TV. Everybody could feel that pain, but nobody feels our pain, you know, because we're the only people in this situation where people in Wisconsin and New Jersey and New York and South Carolina, they don't understand what it's like to be without representation, because they've always had representation. You know, so this makes it a difficult civil rights movement for us. And we need to put some money and effort into getting the word out. You know, 80% of America thinks we have exactly the same rights they do. Because why wouldn't you think that?
Yeah.
You know, somebody said, there's no democracy in the nation's capital. Wouldn't you go, what? You know, and so part of our problem is getting the word out to people and getting them fired up. Because when you explain it to them, I'll tell you a great short story. I'm on the mall giving out literature one day at a big event, and five or six guys that you could tell were GIs, they were in fatigues and stuff, walked by me, and I say to one of them, hey guys, you want to support DC statehood, make people of the district equal? And they look at me and they go, no thanks, pal, just like that, and they walk on. And when they get a few steps further, I said, there are 30,000 veterans in the District of Columbia who do not have the same rights as people across the river who have never served their country. And they all stopped. And the guy, one of them walked back and said, give me the literature. So, you know, once you explain it to people, they're pretty much on your side. But we're not explaining it to people. That's why I started the radio show, so we can get the word out there to people.
Right. And I'm guilty of that as well. I had no idea what was going on.
I grew up in the area and had no idea what was going on. I mean, I moved from Maryland to D.C. when I was 18 years old. And then because I didn't want to pay the outrageous tuition at the University of Maryland, if you didn't live in Maryland, they charged you $25 an hour to go to college. So yeah. I moved back to Maryland so that I could pay, you know, like $20 an hour. I think I paid less for my bachelor's and master's degree than I paid for 1 year of my kids' college education. But I had no idea. I had no idea. That's why I put the sign up in my front yard, because they always say, oh, well, you knew what it was like when you moved here. No, who knows that? Do you live in D.C.?
Do I?
Yeah.
No, I live in New York.
Oh, well, imagine buying a house in D.C. and you say, I found a lovely house on Albemarle Street. And you know, your significant other says, well, we better check out our representation before we put the money. You know, I mean, who does that? Who says, well, before I buy that, you know, beautiful condo on Park Avenue, I'm going to see who's going to represent me first. Come on. You know, that doesn't happen. So that's why I put up the sign. Know that you're going to, if you live here, you're going to live in one of the world's great cities, but you're going to get screwed. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I do this podcast, to get the word out on injustices going on. So those are pretty much all the questions I have, Senator Brown. So thank you so much for joining me. Happy Father's Day as well. And
yes, thanks.
Hopefully in a couple of years we'll see a state of D.C.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And thanks for having me on. And you know, I grew up as a child in North New Jersey. So my great aspiration in life was to live in New York one day. I haven't gotten there yet, but maybe I will. I still buy that lottery ticket, though, so you never know. But thanks so much for having me on. I hope we can talk again. And you know what? Maybe we'll have you on our podcast sometime.
I would love that. Okay. That'd be awesome. Okay. Thanks so much. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.